This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Arizona History, the program where we showcase people, places, and events that have helped to shape our great state. We'll be reading two articles from the Journal of Arizona History that have nothing in common. The first is from Volume 58, Number 2, Summer 2017 of the Journal of Arizona History. This article is entitled Handsome Heroes and Treacherous Villains, The Filming of Zane Grey's Wild Horse Mesa by James E. Babbitt. A longtime student of Arizona history, James E. Babbitt is a former member of the AHS Publications Committee and a frequent contributor to the Journal of Arizona History. On April 21, 1925, the Coconino Sun reported the arrival in Flagstaff of W. L. Griffith, the noted director for the Paramount Famous Players. Griffith, along with other Paramount executives, cast members, seven trick horses, and a carload of equipment, were on their way to Red Lake, or Tonalea, on the Navajo Reservation to begin filming Wild Horse Mesa, the latest in a series of silent movies based on the Western romance novel by Zane Grey. At the same time, Red Lake was a remote trading post some 150 miles northeast of Flagstaff, chosen by Paramount to be the headquarters for the film project. For a few weeks, Red Lake was transformed from a dusty little Indian trading post into a bustling movie location. Grey had first visited the area in the spring of 1913 in the company of the famous Kayenta Indian trader John Wetherill. After viewing Rainbow Bridge, the Navajo's legendary Nonnezoshe, the party proceeded north across the Colorado River, where Grey first set eyes upon the Gaiparowitz, or Paiute for Big Mountain's little brother, Plateau, a vast plateau rising some 2,000 feet above the surrounding terrain. He was deeply impressed by the immense landform, describing it as a red-walled, golden-rimmed, black-fringed tableland, towering above the rest of the wilderness of cloven stone. It seemed to be about 5 miles long, but was in fact 70. It seemed to have a million precipices and insurmountable slopes. It overpowered us, so colossal and inaccessible. Determined to visit the Kaiparowitz, commonly known as Wild Horse Mesa, Grey returned in 1922, guided by Al Doyle, with whom he had toured Indian country in 1911, 1915, and 1919. Their supplies, however, ran out before they reached their goal. The following year, Grey brought movie mogul Jesse Lasky on a trip to scout movie locations. Grey again failed to reach the Kaiparowitz, this time because the Colorado River was in flood. Grey never did visit the plateau, later speculating that it could only be reached by airship. Imagining that the name Wild Horse Mesa might have derived from local stories and rumors of herds of wild horses roaming atop the Kaiparowitz, Grey began to plot a romance novel set in a spectacular locale and involving the capture and sale of wild horses. In April of 1924, he published the first of several installations of his story in Country Gentleman magazine. The tale appeared in book form in 1928. Even before Grosset and Dunlap published Grey's novel, plans were underway to turn the magazine serial into a silent film. Well-known Hollywood screenwriter Lucian Hubbard was hired to adapt the story for the silver screen. George B. Seitz, who later created the Andy Hardy series, was chosen to direct. The plot of Wild Horse Mesa involves a scheme to trap and sell wild horses in order to save storekeeper Lige Melbourne, played by George Irving. Bent Manaroob, played by George McGrill, convinces Melbourne to head an expedition to fence off a funnel-shaped canyon coming off the mesa and stampeding the horses into the trap. Melbourne is accompanied by his daughter, Sue, played by Billy Dove, and his store clerk, Chess Weimer, played by Douglas Fairbanks Jr. Chess's older brother, Chain, played by Jack Holt, known as the best wrangler in wild horse country, also joins the outfit. Chain enlists the help of Toddy Noken, played by Bernard Siegel, chief of the local Paiute Indians, to help him capture Panguitch, the magnificent leader of the wild horses. Chain and his Indian friends are in camp when they are approached by three suspicious-looking men, Bud McPherson, played by Noah Beery, Hod Slack, and Jim Horn, played by a very young Gary Cooper. After attempting to kill Chane and steal his horses, the treacherous trio sets off on an exciting chase. Chane makes a spectacular getaway by plunging his horse off a steep cliff and into the fast-flowing San Juan River, then swimming to the far side where he makes his escape. Paramount executives consulted with pioneer Grand Canyon photographer and river runner Emery Kolb before attempting the dangerous stunt. On Kolb's advice, the scene was moved to a less precipitous locale. After Chane's escape, the thieves capture and grossly mistreat Toddy Noken's daughter Sosie, played by Margaret Morris, and leave her in the desert to die. Outraged, when he hears of Manaroob's plan to use barbed wire to trap horses atop the mesa, Chase convinces Lige Melbourne to abandon the barbarous idea. Bent Manaroob then joins Bud McPherson and his men in an attempt to overpower Chane and Lige and continue with their scheme. Toddy Noken intervenes, killing the horse thieves and avenging his daughter. As hundreds of wild horses gallop across the mesa, Chane rides out to divert the herd away from the barbed wire trap. Along the way, he captures the coveted wild stallion Panguitch. Sue Melbourne, thrilled that Chane has saved the horses from gruesome injury or even death, convinces him to release Panguitch back to the wild. Chane and Sue embrace as Panguitch leads the herd up the cliffs against a setting sun. Situated on a sandy hill overlooking an ephemeral lake along the trail from Tuba to Monument Valley, the Red Lake Trading Post was established sometime in the 1880s by Sam Dittenhofer. Taken over by the Babbitt brothers of Flagstaff in 1891, it has been in operation for more than a century. The property originally consisted of a small wood and stone structure with a secondary story housing the traders' living quarters. The interior walls were constructed from old wooden Arbuckle's coffee crates. Several corrals and modest lodging units were located behind the post. Since the real Wild Horse Mesa was completely inaccessible, the mesas around Red Lake, including White Mesa and Preston Mesa, were selected as substitute scenery for filming. Paramount erected some 60 large canvas tents behind the trading post as sleeping quarters, a mess hall, a cantina, and a makeup studio. Additional corrals were built to contain some of the hundreds of horses seen in the movie. 350 Navajos, recruited through 10 trading posts across a wide area of the reservation, were hired as laborers and extras. Harvey Meyer, U.S. Indian agent at Tuba, was called in to translate and mediate when a wage dispute threatened to halt filming. Paramount executives and cast members, mostly new to Indian country, were unfamiliar with the climate and landscape of the Navajo Reservation. Prior to leaving Hollywood, the studio advised Jack Holt and Billy Dove to pack bathing suits for refreshing dips in Red Lake to cool off from the Arizona desert heat. The hopeful actors were surprised when they found instead a lake bed of dry, hot sand. The movie people were likewise almost totally ignorant of Navajo culture. Before going on location, cast members took sign language lessons to communicate with the local Indians. Their first feeble attempts to converse through weird hand and arm motions were laughable failures. Eventually, they picked up a few words in Navajo. Logistics turned out to be equally challenging. Because some of the filming took place as far as 12 miles from the Red Lake Trading Post movie encampment, direct communication between the camp and the set location was almost impossible. Actor George Irving solved the dilemma by devising a crude heliograph system using mirrors to send messages back and forth. Once filming began, cameraman Bert Glennon organized his 12 assistants to capture the horse stampedes and other action sequences. For one scene, he stationed the camera crews in deep gullies very near the stampeding herds. He then placed his own camera in an exposed position, looking up at the charging steeds, some of whom came within 3 feet of his tripod. Glennon's second unit cameraman, Archie Stout, would go on to win a 1954 Academy Award for his cinematography on John Ford's The Quiet Man. Zane Grey was on the set for much of the several weeks it took to film Wild Horse Mesa. The final version consisted of some 7 reels, 7,164 feet of celluloid. The film was released in early June 1925. Mondrant Hall, in an August 10, 1925 New York Times review, pronounced Wild Horse Mesa quite dull, a problem compounded by the film's awful subtitles. Hall concluded that, despite competent performances by Jack Holt, Noah Beery, and Billy Dove, there are too many old tricks and too much forced villainy and lovemaking to stir up much interest in this production, which for the most part is produced without much sense of humor. Despite such criticism, Wild Horse Mesa enjoyed considerable success at the box office. It was remade in 1932, starring Randolph Scott and Sally Blaine, and again in 1947 by RKO Studios, starring Jack Holt's son Tim Holt, Jason Robards, and Nan Leslie. The 1920s and 1930s saw many Western movies made across northern Arizona, including Zane Grey's The Waterhole, based on Lost Pueblo, Avalanche, and Sunset Pass, all filmed in 1928. Grey's novels and the Western film genre have long since waned in popularity, being replaced by gritty film noir, war movies, and action thrillers. Nevertheless, the rich history of early day movie production in Indian country still makes us marvel at the lengths to which Hollywood went to create entertaining and realistic motion pictures. And that's the end of our article, Handsome Heroes and Treacherous Villains, The Filming of Zane Grey's Wild Horse Mesa, by James E. Babbitt. Now we will read a piece entitled Naming Arizona's San Pedro River by Denny J. Seymour and Ron Stewart. At the time that this article was written, Dr. Denny J. Seymour has been studying the San Pedro and the Sobaipuri for more than three decades. Her research focuses on southeastern Arizona and other portions of the southernmost southwest, and includes missions and presidios along with the indigenous Hokome, Llano, Suma, Manso, and Apache peoples whose presence provided the reason for these establishments and drove colonial policy. She's the author of five books and nearly 100 articles that contribute to her international reputation as an expert on the proto-historic and colonial Southwest. Ron Stewart is a retired information technology professional who is also an avocational historian and archaeologist. A resident of Sierra Vista, he's been an active volunteer in a number of excavations and surveys along the San Pedro River. He's one of the founding members of the Southeastern Arizona Site Stewards Program. He writes articles, gives public lectures, and leads tours related to the archaeology, history, and geology of the area. Residents of the area, historians, and those who are generally inquisitive may wonder about the origin of the name San Pedro River. When was it so named? What does this name refer to? These questions are more difficult to answer than they might seem. The San Pedro River Valley has been home to people for 13,000 years. Paleo-Indian and archaic cultures, Hohokam, Western Pueblos, Trincheras, and Sobaipuri Odom farmers, Apache, and Hokome hunter-raiders, as well as Spanish, Mexican, and American latecomers. The cultural layering is complex, and the historical sources are many and varied. Over the centuries, the river has had many names given by many groups. Will C. Barnes states in Arizona Place Names, "Why or when or how the name of San Pedro came into use has not been definitively ascertained. Well, it is true that various 19th-century forts, haciendas, crossings, and fields, not to mention a community and a land grant, were called San Pedro. The name extends earlier in time." One answer we might expect is that the name originated with Jesuit missionary Father Eusebio Francisco Kino, who visited the area in the late 1600s and early 1700s, but this is not the case. As it turns out, there are just enough documents to suggest that the name San Pedro, as assigned to the river in the valley, has a mid-18th century origin, not later, as assumed by many, including Barnes, nor earlier, as conveyed by local lore and as referenced on the internet. For example, San Pedro, a name that Father Aquino gave to an Indian village located by the river in what is now Mexico. It turns out that there are three questions we must work through to uncover the history. We know that the river bore a number of other names assigned by Europeans before it became the San Pedro. The first question to ask is, when did the name change? Second, why did the change occur? And finally, since in the Spanish period the river and valley were typically named after a settlement, which settlement served as its namesake? Many people, us among them, have assumed that Juan Jaramillo of the Coronado expedition was referencing the San Pedro in 1540 when he discussed the Rio Nexpa. Nexpa is a Nahuatl word for which historians have yet to find a meaning. There is, however, a town and a river in Morelos, Mexico, of the same name, so perhaps the San Pedro reminded the indigenous participants on the Coronado expedition of this place. Jaramillo tersely commented in his journal, "From here one travels in about 4 days through unsettled land to another stream which we understood to be called Nexpa." Although Jaramillo does not give the source or meaning of the word, historian Herbert Bolton seems to clarify the meaning of Jaramillo's statement when he notes that the expedition reached a stream which the natives called Nexpa, as the Spanish understood the word, suggesting that it is likely a native name for the river provided by Mexica, Tarascans, or other native groups with the expedition, or perhaps by local Opata, or so by Puri Oodham informants. Father Eusebio Francisco Quino was active in what is now southern Arizona in the late 1690s and the first decade of the 1700s. At this time, the river was called the Quiburi because of the major Sobaipuri Oodham village of that name along the middle section of the stream. The Quiburi Mountains, shortly thereafter known as the Sierra de la Peñascosa, now known as the Dragoons, to the east, were also named after the village. Quino also appended the name to the saint whose feast day corresponded to the date of his first visit to the native names for most of the indigenous villages he entered, or simply assigned a saint's name. For example, today's Santa Cruz River was called the Santa Maria by Quino, after an Oodham village near the river's headwaters that he named Santa Maria del Pilar. In the case of Quiburi, the saint's name changed as the village moved up and down the stream, as was typical for Sobaipuri Oodham villages. From this practice, it's easy to make the leap and assume that Quino had visited a village along the Quiburi River on San Pedro's feast day, and thus the river acquired its current name. But this is not the case. Quino did not name the river the San Pedro, and there would be no villages or locales called San Pedro along the river for another 2 decades. Quino actually used 2 names for the river, calling it in 1692 the Rio de San Josef de Tarante, or Quiburi. Sources mention 2 communities in the general vicinity of the headwaters of the San Pedro, just north of modern Cananea, when Quino first visited the river, San Josef and Ternate. The river was likely called San Josef de Ternate at the time because of these villages. It was not until 1741 that the presidio named Ternate was established in the headwaters area. San Josef and Ternate seem to have been indigenous Oodham communities. Ternate at this time was also a ranch or estancia. Both locations are illustrated on Jesuit Father Adamo Hilg's map of 1692 and Quino's earliest 1695-1696 map, both reflecting knowledge the 2 missionaries gained during a 1692 trip through the area. Soon after Quino's map was completed, both he and Juan Mateo Manje refer to the settlement in the river as Ternate rather than Ternate. By the early 1700s, the area was called the Valley of the Sobaipuris. This use continued through the 1740s until, seemingly in the early 1760s, the German Jesuits either do not indicate a name for the river, or they reference it as the Valley of the Sobaipuris up until at least 1751. Yet by 1764, the Jesuit missionary Juan Nedvig, in his Rudo Ensayo, refers to it by 2 names, the San Pedro or Sobaipuris River. It appears on Joseph de Urrutia's 1769 map as the Valley of the Sobaipuris and the River of the Sobaipuris. In his journal from the same expedition, Nicolas de la Flora refers to the river in the Sobaipuri Valley, also called San Pedro. From these sources, we can infer that between 1764 and 1769, the transition period may have been longer, the name changed from River of the Sobaipuris to the San Pedro River. This begins to answer the question, when was it named the San Pedro? Apparently the change did not occur all at once, with some people using the old name and some using the new, while writers attempting to be clear referenced both. This was common throughout the mission period, as in the case of Kino's earlier references to the shift from Kiburi to San Jose de Terranate. Why did the name River of the Sobaipuris fall out of use? One might think it had to do with the expulsion of the Jesuit missionaries in 1769, while Urrutia and La Flora were carrying out their inspection. But the change began earlier, at least as early as 1764, suggesting that it may coincide with the 1762 removal of Sobaipuri O'odham from the San Pedro, although only about one-half were actually relocated. Therefore, the name would have no longer been applicable. Different people probably adopted the new name at different times. There are so few sources that it is impossible to know if the name was adopted in some areas before it was in others. Newcomers in the area perhaps adopted it sooner than locals, who had long called it the River of the Sobaipuris. Nonetheless, we know when the transition to the new name occurred, and that for a span of a few years both the old and the new names were used. We also know why the change in names likely occurred, that is, official removal of the Sobaipuri O'odham from the valley. But this does not completely explain the name change. For the rest of the story, we need to consider the location of the San Pedro community that lent its name to the valley. As noted, rivers were sometimes named after a settlement on the river, and the settlements generally had indigenous names to which a saint's name was added as prefix. In fact, San Pedro was the name of a post-Kino O'odham village whose indigenous name has been lost, or at least has not yet been identified in documentary sources. It was located just south of the modern international border and appears in the documentary record in the 1730s as Juan Bautista de Anza was escorting Father Ignacio Keller to his new post at the mission settlement of Santa Maria Suamca on the river of the same name, now known as the Santa Cruz. In the 1730s, the river was still called Terranate and Sobaipuris. While little to no archaeological survey has been conducted, it's a fairly straightforward process to guess the general location of this indigenous settlement, both because of the river channel characteristics in this area and the history of later settlement. There was a stock ranch, an estancia, a community, and some fields called San Pedro toward the headwaters. The San Pedro fields and community were just below or north of the point where the north-flowing San Pedro River comes together to form a single channel from many tributaries and springs. This was a named and known place in the 1780s, when the river was already being called the San Pedro. In 1780, Jerónimo de la Roca y Figueroa noted that the Santa Cruz Presidio troops stationed at Las Nutrias had to plant crops along the river at a place called San Pedro. Antonio Bonilla had noted a bit earlier in 1774 that the inhabitants of the original Terranate Presidio at the headwaters farmed the land along the Terranate River, or San Pedro, about a league and a half from the Presidio. But unlike Roca, he does not use the name San Pedro for the location. The current settlement of San Pedro is likely in the same general location as where the soldiers' fields and the original native settlement of San Pedro were located, as indicated when overlaying its location on old maps to its current position in Google Earth. The river's characteristics here make the adjacent land favorable for agriculture. Along most of the San Pedro, water often flows below the surface or is unavailable year-round. Occasionally, however, bedrock outcrops push water upward and make it available to settlers. Downstream from these constrictions, the river channel broadens, providing areas suitable for fields and canal systems, with laterals streaming off from the main channel. The area between such bedrock features is known as a reach. A reach, such as the one near the headwaters of the San Pedro, were often settled, modified, and improved by prehistoric cultures, and then reused for centuries by O'odham inhabitants and the Spanish, Mexican, and American settlers that followed. These river characteristics would explain the relative stability of the San Pedro settlement in this general vicinity along the river. To conclude, we can now answer the questions posed above. When was this stream named the San Pedro River? Following several other designations, the name came into use by 1764, probably by 1762, and was permanently affixed to the river sometime after 1769, and certainly by 1780. Why was it named the San Pedro? It was named after an Ootam village at the very headwaters of the river that later became a Spanish farm associated with the Spanish presidios nearby. The Ootam village's name was modified to include the saint's feast day, San Pedro, on which Europeans first visited the village. The name was subsequently applied to the Spanish and then Mexican farming villages that are still located at this prime farming location. Details remain to be explored, but this basic information should be of great interest to the residents of Cananea, Morelos, Palominas, Hereford, St. David, Benson, Cascabel, Reddington, San Manuel, Dudleyville, and yes, San Pedro, living today in the valley named by Spanish explorers about 3 centuries ago. And that was Naming Arizona's San Pedro River by Denny J. Seymour and Ron Stewart. And that's the end of our Arizona History program for today. I hope you've enjoyed our 2 stories. This has been Dan Klinger, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then, under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device as well.